Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello, everybody, and happy Tuesday night to you, and happy Alien Invasion Day. Apparently, there was a predicted alien invasion by a famed AI, but nothing has happened. There is no alien invasion, as many, many predictions come to pass, and nothing occurs, you know, much like many, many doomsday predictions, things like that. We'll have to have a whole episode on doomsday predictions because of this, but it's been all over the communities today. So fascinating stuff. Even how that mentality takes over, even how that thought form takes over. We've got a great show tonight. We want to thank our good friends at the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship. We had a great time going to Denver this year and covering their conference, and they did a great write-up on us in their recent newsletter. So thank you guys for that. It was a great conference. It was fantastic to meet all those amazing researchers and really dive headlong into one of my favorite topics, that idea of hidden Shakespeare and who Shakespeare really is. So thank you guys for that. In our second part tonight, we'll be welcoming King Gerhard. He is the author of Big Bird. We'll be talking about Thunderbirds, both the traditional Native American aspect of Thunderbirds, as well as modern Thunderbird sightings, much more in the world of modern pterosaur sightings, things like that. In the first segment, we are pleased to be welcoming Mike Ricksecker. He is the author of the brand new book, Portal to the Stars. He is on so many shows like Unbelievable with Dan Aykroyd. He is the host of Mike's Morning Mug. Welcome to the show, Mike Ricksecker. How are you doing today?
Hey, Christopher. Doing really well. Thanks for having me tonight.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for going on. I've followed your work for quite a while. I have quite a few of your books. Your book on Travels Through Time, which came out, I guess, a year or so ago.
Yeah, it was last year.
2023. It's fantastic, and I've recommended it to a couple people and passed it on to a couple people. And like I was telling you before the show, I just got this book today. Got about 75 pages into it, and it is fascinating stuff. How did you first come to the world of Portal and Stargate and time travel research, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's kind of always been involved with my line of research when it comes to time travel. And that goes all the way back to when I was a kid back in the 80s. Actually, the movie Somewhere in Time, and that idea of being able to will yourself back to some other point in time rather than, you know, the mid 80s when it was a DeLorean and a flux capacitor, yeah, and whisking off at 88 miles per hour, which would be wonderful, be a lot of fun. But there was something about that notion about using the power of the mind to move yourself into another point in time. And so that was an influence of mine, you know, way, way back. Mm-hmm. You know, when it comes to portals and Stargates, I mean, yeah, you could say the film Stargate 1994, when that came out, really interested me. But, you know, that was preceded by the Mysteries of the Sphinx documentary hosted by Charlton Heston. It was John Anthony West, Robert Schock, their research in redating the Sphinx. So you kind of couple those things together. And, you know, as a young, impressionable, 19-year-old at the time? that kind of really inspired me to look into that, you know, really, because I always had paranormal experiences dating back to when I was a young child. I've been an experiencer for pretty much my entire life. And so as I got deeper into that realm, and researching the paranormal, I started discovering that there were a lot of consistencies, a lot of connections between what I was researching in the paranormal realm and this idea of portals and stargates and this sort of thing. So it's always been a part of my research, and finally going to Egypt a few years back just amplified all of that. And I dove headlong into all of that esoterica.
There's tons of it, mountains and mountains of material, especially once you start getting into ancient Egypt, things like that, and especially the lost technologies of Egypt. One of my favorite guests that we have on pretty regularly is Stephen Myers from the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation. And, you know, the idea of, no, we didn't need some kind of alien technology to build the pyramids, you know, We have reinvented humanity numerous times over and forgotten who we are numerous times over. Yeah. So the idea of having technologies that we're just now burgeoning on, things like storing data and crystals, that kind of stuff is brand new to us, but something that in a situation like ancient Egypt, piezoelectricity, things like that may have been pretty commonplace.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right that, you know, civilization has risen and fallen and forgotten itself over millennia. And it's something like Graham Hancock talks about, we're a species with amnesia. Mm. And you know, that idea actually really isn't all that new. You look back into the works of Plato when he was writing about Atlantis. You have Solon, the Greek philosopher, that's down there in Egypt talking to the priests at Sais and Heliopolis. And the one that he's talking to, Sanchez, is laughing at him because, you know, Solon's trying to, you know, tell him about, oh, yeah, you know, we had the great cataclysm, the great flood. These were survivors, all that. And Sanchez is laughing at him like, you Greeks are but children. This has happened many, many times. Yeah. And you have forgotten again and again and again. So, that concept has been with us forever. And so when we look at some of these ancient structures and we're like, oh, my gosh, you know, how did they build those? I mean, it was with some technology that's been forgotten to time. And the traditional academia, they really, you know, bristle at the terminology of, you know, the ancients had a high technology, because their mind automatically goes to computers and cell phones and things like that. I was like, no, not that type of high technology. They had a higher technology in this area than we have today. You know, it doesn't mean it has to be cell phones and this of thing, but it is still a higher technology, just in a different area.
Well, and, you know, that is specifically something that we talk about regularly on the show is exactly the fact of specifically Egyptology amongst many scientific disciplines. The idea that they don't really accept a whole lot of new hypothesis. They don't really accept a whole lot of new theory. Even the idea that the Great Pyramid itself is a tomb. Like, that's funny. There's, I guess you're doing it to imprison that soul forever, because there's no sacred scrawls on the wall for the soul to read, to have their heart weighed, you know, against a feather to enter the afterlife. There's none of that. That, according to Egyptology teaching, you have to have in order to get to the afterlife.
Right. Yeah. You had to have the false door. You don't find that in, you know, the Great Pyramid or, you know, the other ones there, you know, the Red Pyramid, the Ben Pyramid, none of those. The big, giant, huge pyramids in Egypt, you don't find that in. Now, there are smaller ones that were built by the dynastic Egyptians that are really just, they're copying what they're seeing over there. And I can imagine that being a king, like, oh, that great, huge, you know, massive wonder, I want to be buried in something like that. But my guys don't know how to build that whole huge thing. And so they construct a little one. And yes, inside those smaller ones, you can find walls covered in hieroglyphs. You can find stars on the ceiling and things like that. But you don't find that in the bigger ones, because that was an older version of the Egyptian civilization, probably the Atlantean civilization, that built those, because you find no hieroglyphs on the walls. You don't find those false doors. There's no stars on the ceilings. It's a completely different kind of construction.
Well, let's start getting into that different kind of construction and exactly how it relates to Stargate technology and other high technologies of ancient Egypt, Atlantis, etc., Mike.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we find the stargates in ancient Egypt, and that's a tour that we do every year, Stargates of Ancient Egypt tour. We're going again next November 2025. You can find the link to that on my website. And where we find this symbolism is really all over the temples in Upper Egypt. So along the Nile River, you find it at the Temple of Abydos, or Temple of Seti at Abydos, Temple of Hathor at Dendera. You find it at Karnak, Luxor. And the symbolism is right alongside gateways into the temple, right alongside doorways into some of these rooms that were actually the Stargate chambers. Now, there's a lot of ideas and speculation as to what they actually did in the Stargate chambers, what they used them for, but it's very plain as day. You know, the word Stargate is written on the door. So these could have been used, yes, to travel to somewhere else in the cosmos. They could have been used to travel somewhere else on Earth, another dimension, another point in time, as a communications device. So there's a lot of different ideas as to how exactly that they were used. But, you know, the idea of a Stargate is really harnessing the power of a portal to use it at your will. Because portals are naturally occurring. We find them in space right outside our planet. They call them X points, and, you know, which is really an interaction between the Earth's magnetism and the solar wind, which we've had satellites out in space for almost 10 years now studying these things, and there's no predictive model for it. NASA has acknowledged, yes, these are portals. We're going to call them X points because we don't want to, you know, be too metaphysical about it, so we'll call them something else. But they did admit that there are, you know, portals. They open at random intervals. They don't know how big they're going to open. Just it's random, you know, open at random sizes, close randomly. So they're able to study them, but they could not tell you when one is going to spawn up, and they can't tell you when it's going to close. And these type of portals allow the protons and electrons from the sun to enter into our atmosphere a lot quicker than normal. So we know these are naturally occurring. And since they, again, it's an interaction between the Earth's magnetism and the solar wind, well, that goes all the way down, that interaction, all the way down to the Earth's surface. So these portals can open really anywhere. And that's, I believe, where we start having some of these stories about people going missing in the wilderness, possibly through a portal. You have some of these missing airplanes, possibly through a portal. Bruce Gernon has a fantastic story down in the Bermuda Triangle about passing through one of these things and being zipped ahead, you know, over half an hour in time. So, yeah, a very, very fascinating subject to study here.
Well, especially when you get into portals, it is absolutely fascinating. We know that we have now teleported light in the lab. We have altered time. We know that time is pretty much, as far as physics goes, just made up.
It's
relative to the observer and only explainable by the observer. So that's why you need a totally different type of clock to tell time on the moon or in space, things like that. Gravity is, if you went to the Io near Jupiter, it would be a totally different time system than 60 minutes to an hour.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, they're trying to designate time zones up on the moon now, which I find pretty laughable. Have at it, guys. Yeah, you know, time is just it's a human concept. It's used to describe our reality. It's used to keep track of things like, you know, when we need to show up at work, when we need to show up at the bus stop, you know, that sort of stuff. So it's a helpful tool for us, but it's just a human concept. It doesn't really exist. You know, what we are experiencing is our fourth dimensional consciousness. I mean, what we call time is the fourth dimension. Sure. And that's basically where our consciousness exists, inside a three-dimensional body. So that makes us really fascinating beings, because we are multidimensional. Fourth dimensional consciousness inside a three-dimensional body. When the three-dimensional body passes, our consciousness goes, well, that's the big question. Where do we go?
Yeah.
Do we go to one of those other dimensions, because we have up to 11 of them, or do we go to somewhere else beyond that? And, you know, even scientists now, Stuart Hameroff, Robert Penrose, in their concepts of the consciousness being stored in the microtubules of the brain, you know, they've even acknowledged, and these are guys that, you know, Roger Penrose, like, well, you know, you call me an atheist, but because religiously he doesn't, you know, believe in religion as a scientist. But he says, you know, that consciousness that is stored inside the body, it goes off to the cosmos somewhere. I couldn't tell you where, but it goes somewhere. And so that's left to, you know, people like us to try to figure that out.
Well, and that's just it. You know, it's the idea that we talk about pretty regularly on the show, that we are conscious vibration, you know, held here by quantum field, what have you. And that vibration is never ending. It doesn't change, much like any energy. It can only change form. It can't be created or destroyed.
Right.
You know, so that's kind of a quandary of physics. The fact that you can change the way that energy is, you know, you can change the vibrational rate of it. But you can't destroy it. So where do we go? What does happen? And even when you start looking at things like remote viewing, the idea that, yes, you can remote view something that happened in the past. You can remote view something that happens in the future, but quantum things in between here and then may mitigate what happens to that situation, you know?
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Yeah, there can be changes. So just because you view something in the future doesn't mean that's the way it's going to happen. And you can have things in the future changing things that happened in the past. And so this is where we end up with a lot of these paradoxes and things like the Mandela effect. But yeah, since it, you know, I get this question a lot when I start talking about time, you know, all time being concurrent, past, present, future, all here at once in our fourth dimension. And so some people get hung up on, well, doesn't that mean that, you know, then we're, you know, predestined, it's all mapped out. And it's like, no, you can still make choices. And that is going to change things up and down the timeline based on your choices. And the universe is going to, you know, correct that up and down that timeline.
Yeah.
So we still have free will. It's just it's different than our, you know, conventional take on it, so to speak, that I think we have to think outside the box. We have to think in multiple dimensions, and, you know, not just this, you know, point A goes to point B. You know, point A can go to, you know, a lot of different points.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of the idea behind these portals that you were just talking about, that appear in our cosmos, appear between the sun and the earth, things like that, that randomly appear, pop up, disappear. What would it take? Because there's, of course, the idea of the Einstein-Rosen bridge, the idea of a wormhole that can open up between space and time, between that fabric, basically bending space over itself,
right,
and shortening the time distance between two points by doing so. But what would it take for one of those to exist? What would it take for one of those to be manipulable, even via vibration of crystals or crystalline structures? In, because I mean, I'm a huge user and believer of crystals. I believe, if anything, the ancient civilizations were tapped into the piezoelectric properties of crystals, and into the way that they can change vibrationally a space. Yeah.
That's a great.
Go ahead.
Right. Yeah. Great question. You have a lot there. So let me try to unpack that a bit. You know, the big trick with when we talk about the Einstein-Rosen bridge and folding over space and time, I mean, that's the trick. How do you fold over space and time? I mean, I can't, you know, do that with my hands. We give the example, right? So how do we make that happen? There are scientists a couple years ago in the lab, Fermilab, where they, you know, they published a paper that they had created a baby wormhole in the lab. This is on the quantum level. They created two small black holes, connected them with a wormhole, and sent a message through, which is a great breakthrough. It's kind of like the very, very early beginnings of being able to create this in the lab. And, you know, people are asking questions. Well, can you send like a dog through it? You know, it's like, come on, we're on the quantum level. No. Why would you send a dog first? You know, let's send a probe or something through it. But so it's very small, and we were able to send a message. I think the ancients were onto a lot of things here, being able to, you know, harness that those portals and be able to use them at their will, which is, again, what we call the stargates. And, you know, you mentioned the piezoelectric energy, and, you know, we find a lot of these types of sites, built on, you know, what we call, you know, these hotspot energies or hotspot areas around the world. There might be triangle areas. We know the stone circles were built on these temples and all of that. And basically, we're talking about the telluric current of the Earth and, you know, where these triangles and hotspots are at. You know, it goes all the way down to the Earth's core. You have that molten ball of iron spinning around and around, creating an electromagnetic field.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's great for us because it protects us from the sun, like we were talking about earlier. But as it rises up through the Earth's mantle and the crust, it's interacting with different metals and minerals. And depending on the metal or mineral it interacts with and the quantity, it creates these different localized electromagnetic fields. So, yeah, using crystals definitely would have an effect on these. We find the idea of using monatomic white gold there in ancient Egypt. You go to the Temple of Abydos and you find the depiction of it on the wall, what they call the what has routinely been called the Mufkuts, but our Egyptologist there in Egypt, Mohammed Ibrahim, he's been looking at that for a number of years. His head scratched at him. He's like, why are you calling this Mufkuts? Mufkuts means turquoise, but you have this depiction of white cakes. And so he's been studying this for a while. And what he has deduced here is that, oh, okay, I get it now. It's the white gold, then the white cakes from Mufkut's land, the turquoise land, which makes sense. The turquoise land was in the Sinai Peninsula where all of these ancient mines were at. So they were mining gold, silver, the turquoise, of course, copper, and all these sorts of things. And this monatomic white gold was a byproduct of this mining, and they're mixing it into these white cakes and then entering into the Stargate's chambers. So, and given the properties of what monatomic white gold can do, you know, it can change your chemical composition. It can basically change not chemical composition, but change your vibration, change your frequency is what I mean to say. And so, you know, some of the tests that they've done on this in the lab where it, like, you know, totally disappears, possibly to another dimension. You know, imagine ingesting something like that. You go into this chamber. So are you passing into another dimension yourself? Are you going to another point in time? Is it almost like maybe it's, you know, an experience like ayahuasca where your body is physically there, but your consciousness is pretty much elsewhere and you're interacting with different beings and having these visions and things like that. So, you know, we don't know exactly what it did and how it worked, but we can see that there was something going on here.
Well, and, you know, there are two things that spring to mind whenever you bring up the monatomic white gold. Number one is the mana machine.
Yeah.
And the idea of where did they get the mana from in Egypt during the time of the Exodus, and what was it? And the concept that, you know, that they actively had a machine that was technology that made this, and it was basically monatomic white gold.
Right.
That's well, pretty
and think about where were they walking through during the Exodus? They were walking through the Sinai area, which is where these mines were at. That was producing the monatomic white gold. So yeah, it all ties together. It all connects.
That is really fascinating stuff. And you know, what other evidence do we have of monatomic white gold use in ancient Egypt or in ceremonial high magic use, anything like that, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, we find that at a number of the temples. We find that in the wall friezes, the bas reliefs that are all over the temples. You'll find that offering, and so basically, you have to, you know, look for that offering and, you know, look into the hieroglyphs. Okay, is this an offering? Oh, there it is. The Hebshait from Mufkut's land is essentially what we're looking for. So we see a number of different temples there.
Now, do we have any idea how they went about creating this monatomic gold? Because, I mean, typically that's not something that you would necessarily mine. That's something that kind of like, you know, monatomic silver, things like that, that you have to create through a chemical process.
Yeah. This would have been a chemical process. And we know that, you know, ancient Egypt, as far as we know, when we go back into our ancient history, the records that we have to this point, you know, they were our creators of alchemy. You know, they are our original alchemists. Now, that go back further, like we go back to the Atlantean civilization and what have you. It may have been passed down from there, you know, but, you know, they were the possessors of alchemy. And so they wouldn't have been specifically mining for monatomic white gold. I mean, maybe, you know. Yeah. They don't let me put words in their mouth. But like when we look at the work of David Hudson in Arizona, you know, this was a byproduct of the mining that he was doing there. So given that they were mining all these other substances, it makes sense that this was a byproduct of what they were mining there in the Sinai. And through whatever alchemical process that they had devised, were able to produce this. Now, that process is not listed on any of the walls or anything like that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that the process didn't exist, you know, because after all, you know, there are no instructions in hieroglyphs on how they built the pyramids. There's no instructions in hieroglyphs and mummification. So there's a lot of things that they did that they never recorded. So that doesn't mean just because it wasn't recorded that the process didn't exist for them.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a good evidence of use of high technology in ancient Egypt. I mean, everything from gold-plated artifacts to which, I mean, you'd had to have either a chemical or electrochemical process to make that happen, which is a pretty decent understanding of chemistry as far as how to suspend something inside of a chemical solution and long enough for the atoms to change place. You know, like, I mean, I remember transferring, making pennies silver and things like that in chemistry class in high school.
Oh,
and
sure.
And it was definitely something that, like, you left overnight, you know, and that was just a small item. I can't imagine what it would take for gold. Things like that. But we know that they had things like the Baghdad battery, for example, that produces easily from 1 to 2 AA batteries in strength. So, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, even science has shown here a few years back that, you know, you have Christopher Dunn's idea of the Giza power plant. Well, you know, science showed us a few years back that, yes, the Great Pyramid of Giza is harnessing the earth energy and storing it within the pyramid itself. And then just recently here, a few months back, you know, China releases this report on some, you know, radar testing that they were doing and discovering that there, you know, were plasma balls forming up over the Great Pyramid. So, you know, and that's today, thousands and thousands of years later. So imagine back in its heyday when it was actively in use, how much more powerful that would have been.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you know, I think on a much more impactful scale, especially.
Yes.
Because while it may not seem amazing to us, you know, the idea that I constantly refer to the idea of piezoelectricity, and the idea of if you take two decent quartz crystals and bang them together in the dark, you'll see a flash of light.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so for ancient peoples, for people 10,000 years ago, yes, that would have verged on magic to see in front of your eyes. That would have, and then to find out that that same action could actively generate power, you know, so much of our life is run off of piezoelectricity nowadays. And it's a very small device. It doesn't take a whole lot to make happen, you know? So the idea that they could have found out how to coax power out of crystals, how to specifically coax power out of the weighting capacitor that is granite.
Yes.
You know, I mean, that's layers of mica and carbon and quartz. Like you've got a capacitor waiting to happen at that point.
Absolutely. And when, you know, you look at Aswan rose granite, I mean, that, you know, there are many different types of granite across the world, but Aswan rose granite has one of the highest quartz contents in the entire world. And Egypt was loaded with it. And that's what they used in all their, I mean, a lot of the buildings were limestone or maybe even sandstone, but they used granite in all of their constructions to some degree or another. You know, the important chambers there in the Great Pyramid of Giza are made of granite. You walk into any of the temples, the threshold was always granite. And that was so that as you walked into the temple, it would clear your energy. So it would purify you as you walked into the temple. And then, of course, you know, you have the obelisks and, you know, so many other, like the massive coffers there at the Serapeum, all made of this, you know, massive blocks of granite that, yes, had the piezoelectric energy involved in it. And, of course, we're left scratching our heads trying to figure out how in the world they even move these things.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. Like, how did they even get them into place? And how do even the concept, because the idea of frequency specifically, Mike, when you're talking about even moving objects, you know, like we know, like you can hop onto Amazon right now and for $80 buy a DIY acoustic levitation kit where it floats a little pith ball on your desk, you know. But if you upscale that and if you start thinking about, you know, other forms of ultrasonic technology, once again, rubbing quartz together, things like that to create ultrasonic signals. Even the idea that the Great Pyramid itself, the King's Chamber, the first resonant frequency in it is 19 hertz. That is that is one hertz below the range of human hearing, the range that is frequently associated with the paranormal, with feeling the presence of something else in the room with you. It is the frequency at which the water in the eye starts to vibrate and ocular hallucinations begin. You know, so to think about that in terms of an initiation space, something like that, something that would be used as, let's say, a star chamber, a portal, something that would take you body and mind to another place because of the resonant vibration in it.
Yeah.
You know, that in and of itself is the idea of bringing your brain to the point of time travel and moving into another dimension and shifting your space of reality.
Yeah. And I absolutely believe that the Great Pyramid of Giza was some sort of machine. You know, we find the evidence for it, you know, all throughout there. I mean, you could say, okay, no body was ever found. The King's Chamber, you have, I call it a coffer. You know, because it's a box. But the interesting thing is that, again, you know, we're talking Aswan rose granite that's in that chamber, and it's all either brown or black. You know, that only happens through some sort of chemical reaction. And actually, if you look at the blocks that are at the very top of the ceiling, you find these other rectangular slats that are in the middle of the blocks, and they line up like really quite perfectly with that box that's in that room. So when you look up at it, it's like, yeah, there. This isn't just sitting around over time and somehow became, there was a chemical reaction.
Yeah.
And even down in the Queen's Chamber, yes, they have found salt and things like that on the walls, a nice layer of it. But that niche that's in there, that's inset into the one wall, it's a little corbelled niche. And traditional archaeology tries to say, well, you know, there could have been like a statue or an idol sitting there. And I guess somehow it got stolen. Well, okay, it doesn't make sense then that behind that niche, there's a small tunnel that goes back about 90 meters. And then the whole backside of that niche above that tunnel is blackened, like something that was burned there. It's charred, and the stone is actually melted. So something extremely, extremely hot happened there. It wasn't some statue or idol. So, yeah, it was. The whole building was some sort of massive machine.
Yeah, and that's kind of the hypothesis that Stephen Myers puts forth with the work of the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation, is the idea of it was a very large water pump that basically operated on a single cylinder principle, and the idea that expanding gases in the King's Chamber would, through suction, pull water up and water the entire valley to. You know, because at one point, yes, that was a hugely lush area, you know, before it was the desert that it is now.
Yeah. And any of those ideas. So the idea of the water pump, the idea of the power plants, I mean, they're all interesting ideas. And I don't know if we're ever going to know for certain what exactly it was and how it functioned. But not a tomb, okay? And we have to remember, you know, the most important thing for the Egyptians back at that time was the inundation season to grow crops. They had a limited amount of time to grow this stuff. It's when the basically the Nile River flooded and you had the rich black soil that would wash down, and that's where they got their name. The name wasn't Egypt. That's you know, that's a Greek name. It was Kemet. The black land, and for name for the rich black soil. And so that was the most important thing to them, was making sure that they had a good harvest. So I think, you know, whatever that function of the pyramid was, whether it was, you know, energy, whether it was generating energy to, you know, help spread across the land, give us a better crop, heighten consciousness, that sort of thing. Or like you're saying, water pump, or Stephen Meyer saying water pump. You know, any of those ideas I think are on the table, because the most important thing to the Egyptians were the crops.
Yeah, absolutely. And now, when it comes bringing this back around to stargates and to other technologies, what other examples do we have of places where people may have used the natural frequency of the area, the natural ley lines, that kind of stuff, and amplified them through the technology of the time, through placement of stones, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, we find that in like stone circles all throughout the world. You know, it's been a lot of interesting research in the UK. I show some examples in the book on the Rollwright stones, research that's been done there in past years, Avebury, where, yeah, there are, you know, resonant frequencies that these stones are harnessing and passing around the circle and creating this spiraling energy, you know, within it. And, you know, they could have used this energy for a lot of different things. Whether it was for, you know, healing purposes, it could have been used for, of course, they were performing some sort of ritual with it. It could have been entering into altered states of consciousness. The idea of portals, again, is absolutely on the table. There are some interesting stories like a Stonehenge of people that have disappeared there and things like this. And so, yeah, you have these measurable frequencies, this measurable energy that's coming from these locations. And when you look at like a place like the Rollwright Stones, where you see this, you know, spiraling energy that is coming out of the ground. Basically, it's a vortex. You know, the vortex is swirling up out of the ground into this stone circle. Well, that's the three-dimensional aspect, okay, the swirl. But 2D, you just basically take a slice out. That's your spiral. And we see that symbolism all over the world of the spiral. We see it in Egypt. We see it in, you know, all over the UK. We see it in Ireland. We see it in Sardinia. We see it in the American Southwest. We see it in Sri Lanka. It's the same symbol over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And so in that, and you know, the ancients would tell you, this is our symbol for spiral. The indigenous people of the American Southwest, this is our symbol for spiral. And, you know, modern academia is like, oh, that's a migration pattern. What?
Yeah.
Who migrates in a spiral? I mean, doesn't make sense.
Well, and it is fascinating how much modern academia does dismiss the teachings of Aboriginal peoples as just hearsay. When it's like, that's funny, because they have fully, in an unbroken chain, believed this for some of them tens of thousands of years.
You know, absolutely.
And when you start getting into especially portals, things like that, stargates, at sacred spaces, that kind of stuff, it is not a part of their hearsay or their bedtime stories or something like that. It is a deep part of their religious ceremony and a deep part of their actual religious belief that this is a connection to somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. This was their way of life. And, you know, modern academia will say, well, you know, word of mouth is unreliable. But you have to remember, these people, that what they were passing down was for survival. If they pass down the wrong information, you know, their entire culture is going to get wiped out. So they were very, very careful with what they passed down. And modern academia says, well, You know, you remember when you played, the game telephone in first grade, and by the time the message got around to the end of the room, it was completely different. It's like, well, yeah, we were 6 years old. So by the time it got to the third person, you turned the story about the car into a story about a hot dog because you're goofy kids. You know, that doesn't work. That doesn't fly. So, the indigenous and aboriginal peoples were very, very meticulous with the information that they passed down. And, you know, I'm sorry. I'm going to believe the descendants of those that pass this information down. They were the witnesses. Your interpretation as a scholar, I'm sorry, I don't care how many PhDs you have.
Yeah.
You weren't there. These people's ancestors were.
Well, and, you know, that is a regular topic of discussion on this show, is the fact that all too frequently science forgets that first step of science. And all too frequently, the experiencer forgets that they have started the science.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that first step of science is experience and observation. Then you gather data based on that, and then you form a hypothesis. But like as an experiencer, things like that, so frequently people forget that they have started the scientific process. Whether or not they decided to hop on the train of it is a different story. You know, but the science has already begun. And so frequently, especially when it comes to paranormal, when it comes to topics like this, Mike, when it comes to things even like Graham Hancock, and I love the way Graham Hancock answers it. I never said I was a scientist.
Right.
I am a reporter. And I'm just
he's an investigative journalist.
Yeah,
and you know what?
I'm following a trail of clues.
Yeah.
Nothing more.
And this is where it's led me. Being in that position. So, you know, I didn't have a journalist job like Graham did. You know, his career started abroad, and he started noticing, the customs there in Ethiopia. So he ended up writing a book. You know, he was on location covering a different story, but he noticed, these things going on in Axum. And so he started writing about it. And that's kind of how he fell down the rabbit hole. he was an investigative journalist, and that's kind of, you know, my take here. My degree is in it's computer science. My degree is in simulation programming. So, that's, you want to talk about simulated universe or something. I mean, I can give you, some some particulars. But I became curious about all of these different things. And it's freeing because, I'm not stuck in the box of geology. I'm not stuck in the box of archaeology or some of these other sciences, where I can step back and I can look at how all of these different fields on, take a location, Stonehenge or the pyramids or whatever. And I can take everybody's research on that and find the connections together. And that's what we were able to do. Like, Graham saying, piecing the clues together. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and that's just it. You know, it's the idea of you can't really find a Bigfoot expert because we haven't proven Bigfoot. But you can find a lot of people that are expert on the folklore. You can find a lot of people that are expert on primate DNA. You can find a lot of people who are like, Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum. Who are experts in their field in a different right, who are studying this because scientifically it's such an anomaly that we can't ignore it, you know, and that's just it. Eventually science is supposed to be to the point of, wow, this part we can't ignore. And that's one of the reasons I'm a big fan of the relabeling to UAP from UFO, is because it brings phenomenology into it, which is fully a part of science. And the idea of like, okay, so, out of your 100% solution, 5% disappeared. Did it off gas? Did it become sediment? What happened? Now we have to solve for the missing 5%, and that's the anomaly in the experiment. And if we can repeat that, then we have repeatable science. But on both sides of the conversation, Mike, we have to be willing to meet in the middle.
I think that, far too often traditional academia gets hung up on this idea of, supernatural, paranormal, just the term. Mm-hmm. They don't want to discuss it at all. But I like a quote from Dr. Hans Holzer years ago, where he said, there is no supernatural world. Everything that we are experiencing is actually quite natural. And I love that, because it is very true. You know, these things that we are dubbing as paranormal or supernatural are kind of those exceptions to the rule. There are things that don't usually happen to us. They are, you know, something very rare that occurs. You know, it's that like 5% that you are talking about. And so it is a part of our world. It is a part of our universe. And it's a fascinating part of it because they are the more mysterious elements of our universe. And so, yeah, it drives me nuts when traditional academia tries to pawn off, no, it doesn't really exist. I'm like, no, it does. That's the other 5%. Yeah. What is it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, a great example that I like to give, there was a recent study that was just done. I love petroglyphs. I'm huge into them. Mm-hmm. I've been writing an album based on petroglyphs.
Great.
But there was a big study that was just done on some in South America where it actually showed that the ones that I've always interpreted as square waves, that's kind of the concept behind my album, is what if the people who drew these things were synesthetic and were mm-hmm. actually like drawing the sound wave of what they were hearing in the world around them.
Oh, okay.
So pretty phenomenal. And when you isolate those and start putting them through algorithms, some really cool sounds come out. But yeah. This study showed the fact that the square pattern specifically at this site was the drumming pattern that was supposed to be used for the sacred ceremony at that site. So it was literally encoded in the wall art. Whoever the sacred drummer was would have been passed down. Nobody else mm-hmm. knew what that was. None of the tribes at that point, even now locally, knew what that was.
Right.
So at some point, even they'd forgotten what their sacred wall art and what that pattern on the wall meant. Mm-hmm. So the idea of vibration, the idea of those sacred drumming patterns, things like that, whether they be a binaural beat, what have you, that activates the brain to another mm-hmm. dimension, you know, the same way as meditation,
yeah,
something like that, or even once again opens a portal. Because of the vibration and its relative
very well
space.
Could be. And, you know, one of the more fascinating experiences that I'd had, was a smaller stone circle in Ireland. It's called Drombeg Stone Circle. It's an axial stone circle, which basically means that one of the stones is lying down horizontally, as part of the circle. And it lines up with, I think that one is the, morning of the winter solstice, if I recall correctly. But when you walk into this thing, you pass through these two, very tall erect stones. And yeah, there you go, Drombeg Stone Circle. And they call them the portal stones. But when you stand in the center of that thing and just talk, like you're in the dead center and you just talk, you feel the reverberation around you. It's almost like you're in a bubble or like that fishbowl effect, right? And that's just from talking.
Yeah.
Today. Now imagine, you know, a couple thousand years ago when this thing was in its full glory and all the stones were there, because there's only 13 of the what they believe were the original 17 that are there. They're not weathered down like they are right now. Yeah. They've been full height. So imagine doing like a ceremonial chant in the middle of this thing, or playing some instruments in the middle of this thing, and how that sound would have reverberated off those stones, that resonance that would have been coming right back at you. You could use that for a lot of different things, you know, whether it was a specific meditation. We have seen how sound can be used for healing purposes, you know, to, you know, get rid of tumors and things like this. You know, the medicineless hospital in China is like, you know, fascinating what they've done with sound technology there, or entering into altered states of consciousness, maybe opening portals, these sorts of things. It's just, to me, that was just truly fascinating, just standing there just talking and feeling that.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And that was that was a big study that was recently done at Stonehenge as well, was the fact mm-hmm. that and I brought it up on screen, the idea that the stones themselves amplify sound.
Yeah.
And I was just trying to look it up, the scientist who's a paleo musician, who showed that, you know, they actively had stones that they chipped and honed and got mm-hmm. to a point that you could strike it and it rang like a xylophone key. So the idea that the stone circle itself may have been an instrument that was played or beaten like a drum while somebody was inside of it to expose them to frequencies. even it, what one of my hypotheses with the Great Pyramid is the two shafts and how they are slightly offset from each other, and how that, especially with the baffles in it, would almost make like a perfect straw to be able to provide a pitch to resonate the chamber, you know, in a binaural beat fashion.
Yeah, you'll like my hypothesis then on some of these bigger pyramids. So, okay, I've talked about the Great Pyramid of Giza being a machine. You look at that Grand Gallery and just the corbelled structure in there. You look at the construction of the Bent Pyramid, which has other corbelled structure, and then the Red Pyramid. So I think that these were harmonic resonance chambers.
Absolutely.
I think it was some sort of sound technology that was used within these giant pyramids. Yeah,
which you know, once again, if you're talking about the baffles, because if it's there for the spirit to escape, then why the baffles to block them in? But if you're using that as a means of pitch control, because much like any straw that you have, you know, blowing with the breeze by it, you're going to have a pitch coming out of it, and if you lengthen or shorten that straw, you're going to get a different pitch. So, yeah, you can tune the room with those two different angles absolutely vibrate it at the frequency that you want and be producing a piezoelectric result, which explains a lot of the damage, things like that, that look like the sarcophagus that's in there has been chipped away, broken, So, yeah.
So we had on our last Stargates of Ancient Egypt tour this past April, we had a woman with us. She's a performing artist in Europe, primarily like Switzerland, Germany. Steph LeChef is her name. And so we were in the central chamber of the Red Pyramid, and she sang in there, and it was just beautiful. It's like, that's what this room was used for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something to do with sound. Yeah.
Yeah, no, precisely. And when you start looking at so many places like Malta, those chambers where, once again, resonating at almost 19 hertz, things like that, where it's very much tapping into the next dimension, what's around us, whether you're trying to tap into it for a connection to your ancestors, what have you. But the ancients had an amazing, Epidaurus was always one that I remember going there when I was 19 years old and hearing my professor strike a match at the bottom of Epidaurus while we were up top. I'm an audio engineer by trade, and it still just blows my mind to know that like that wooden match sounded like it was right next to me, and it was 200-300 feet down.
That's
just
amazing.
Just blew my mind. And that was geometry that they knew, for us, high technology. We use computers to tune rooms like that for construction now.
Right.
Whenever you're building an opera house, that kind of stuff. They did it on the regs.
Yep.
So it's pretty.
Yeah, it was a different type of high technology, but they absolutely had it. Yeah.
Yeah, and these things do lead to different connections of reality. They do lead to different opening of chakra points.
Yes.
Things like that. So yes, as far as I'm concerned, whether you're talking an actual travel through time or whether you are talking somebody's altered perception of time. Where they go, they have a visionary experience and they come back. I don't necessarily consider them different, Mike.
Yeah. All of these things, and that's part of my platform, you know, Connected Universe Portal. All of these things are connected, and it's just, you know, we're putting the pieces together now through our modern lens. And I think, you know, we talked a bit about here about the differences in what, you know, high technology really is between us and the ancients. And I think our modern society a lot of times forgets to put that ancient technology into the context of the ancients. We try to put our modern lens on it, and it just doesn't work. We have to put ourselves into the mindset of those ancient peoples and the way they would have lived, the way they would have worked, and the way they would have interacted with their environment, which is far different than the way we interact with it today.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, it was very much a live or die interaction, Mike. Like we were saying a while ago, there, it wasn't in their vested interest to obstruct or corrupt the stories that they passed down. If you didn't pass down the proper story as to why that constellation rose in the sky when it did, suddenly crops ain't getting in the ground right.
Right.
You aren't moving as a society with the food that you need to hunt at that point. You know, like these are life breaking decisions that you make sure you pass them down accurately.
Oh yeah,
you
know? Absolutely. And people ask, well, you know, if, you know, these things were so important, like the building of the pyramids and, you know, all this other, you know, the high technology that we've been talking about, how they, you know, constructed these blocks and tools that we know that they had to have had, but haven't shown up in the archaeological record yet.
Yeah.
You know, people always ask, well, you know, why didn't it write down or why didn't they pass that down? And you know, I think people tend to forget that, you know, yeah, if you make a mistake like that and you don't survive and there's famine, and, you know, your civilization can get wiped out. Or, you know, well, we're talking about some barbaric times where, you know, you didn't just, you know, invade a territory and say it's ours. You wiped out the entire population.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Whatever they knew was gone.
Yeah,
so,
you went lion pride on it. You came in, you killed the firstborn, you know, to assert your dominance and to make sure that there was no vendetta afterward, you know.
Yep.
And it, kind of the example that I give regularly, I'm Cajun. It does not take long. There is now a movement to reteach Cajun in Louisiana, because in one generation, Mike, all but gone.
Yeah.
The language is all but gone. It does not take long for us to forget these things.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, well, you know, the last scribe that knew how to write the ancient hieroglyphs, I mean, that was around 300 AD. And, yeah, that wasn't long after, you know, you had the, you know, the Greeks took control, then the Romans. And, you know, through all of that, you know, they started losing their culture. Finally, you know, that last guy dies. Nobody knows how to read the hieroglyphs anymore. And it's taken us, you know, what it take us 1500 years to finally figure it out. And even still, we're kind of iffy on some aspects of it. So,
yeah. Without the Rosetta Stone, we would have nothing.
Oh, yeah. Without the Rosetta Stone, we would have nothing. So thank you, Napoleon.
And even then, that's only a portion and only a very specific type, you know, because there were religious and then there were regular hieroglyphs. So it's kind of like saying that like Latin was a spoken language. No, not really.
Yeah. not really.
Nobody went around like, you know, e pluribus unum, everybody. That isn't how it worked. So yeah,
there are still hieroglyphs today. They have no idea, you know, what they were, because, you know, there'll be like a single hieroglyph sitting there and, you know, they'll try to put it into some sort of context or might mean this, but they don't know. You need to find multiple representations of it to really try to figure out what some of the, I mean, yes, most of ancient Egyptian is a phonetic language, but you have a lot of these other determinatives. You do have some ideograms and things like this in the mix that, you know, leave you scratching your head sometimes, especially if there's only one of these, you know, particular ideograms that's sitting there. And, you know, there's one with the, you know, it looks like a bird man. At the Temple of Seti in Abydos, we have no idea what it is. Maybe it represents flying. There's another in a tomb there at Saqqara. Looks like a flying saucer. So people say it's a flying saucer.
Like the one that looks like the helicopter. You
well,
know.
There are those. That's at Abydos on the lintel. And so those are controversial about, you know, are they modern machinery or something like that? And so, you know, traditional archaeology says, well, you know, they were plastered over and the plaster fell out and, you know, all that. And so, yeah, those are a little iffy. But
and that's just it. You know, even when it comes to, once again, the idea of Egyptology and what is and what isn't. It's one of those that almost verges on it being religious, where a whole lot of new hypothesis is not really brought to the table, or what's there is not really questionable.
Right.
Even given new data set, not really supposed to be questioned.
Well, here's the thing about those particular hieroglyphs. There are definitely hieroglyphs throughout Egypt in which, you know, the ones that were chiseled in, because you have two different kinds. One's you know, that are exposed outward and others that are convex and concave.
Yeah.
So the ones that are concave, you know, inset into the stone rather than like the embossed convex. You know, other variations of where they have filled in that those hieroglyphs with the plaster and then carved other hieroglyphs over the top, because that's what they're saying is happening. We do find that throughout Egypt where that has been done. The problem is when that plaster has fallen out, we haven't seen, you know, the strange combinations to create, you know, modern machinery. It's only in this one spot where this happens. And there are, you know, hundreds of other examples of where that hasn't happened and when they've replastered over. So, yeah, so it's hard to say.
Yeah, it's a fascinating mystery, to say the least, and one of those that I think will probably remain a mystery for a long time. But the research that you have done for Portals to the Stars, Mike, absolutely incredible. Once again, I am about 75 pages in, and I cannot wait to tear through the rest of this over the week. Thank you so much for your time tonight. It's been fantastic. The time flew by. Before we let you go, please do let everybody know where they can go to follow Mike's Morning Mug, where they can go to keep up, where they can go to vote for your book in the Conscious Awakening Awards. All that kind of good stuff for the Conscious Life Expo. Time for shameless promotion. Let everybody know where they can find everything.
Yeah. My primary website is MikeRicksecker.com. My other site, which is a community online learning portal, that's ConnectingUniversePortal.com. That's the site that Christopher has up here. But yeah, you can find my books through there. You can find my books through MikeRicksecker.com. Sign up for my newsletter, all that fun stuff too. Yeah. The Conscious Life Expo, which is at the beginning of February next year. It's the 7th through the 10th. The book awards, Portals to the Stars is up there now for the Conscious Life Expo Book Awards. So consciouslifeexpo.com/book-awards. Yeah, vote for Portals to the Stars there. I would definitely appreciate that. And then, yeah, if you want to join on the Stargates of Ancient Egypt tour with us this coming year, 2025, you can find that. That should be updated. Yeah, that's the new one there, Stargates of Ancient Egypt, November 11th through 23rd, 2025. You can also find that link through my MikeRicksecker.com website. So, yeah, we'd love to have you join us. We're visiting a couple of new sites this time around. But, we'll go through all of those Stargate temples. We have 2 hours in the Great Pyramid just to ourselves. Wow. Our group, the entire thing is open to us. So we get into all the chambers. It's really a phenomenal time.
Too cool, man. Awesome. Once again, I love watching everything that you do online. You were out leading these tours and doing this kind of research all the time. So, thank you so much for your time. It's been fantastic. I look forward to having you back on the show again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Christopher. It was a wonderful conversation. I look forward to coming back again.
You bet. Take care. Have a great evening, Mike.
You too. Enjoy awesome. Your holidays.
You bet. Man. Amazing stuff from Mike Ritzecker, everybody. Make sure to stop on by and check him out. His books are absolutely amazing. His work is phenomenal. Speaking of phenomenal work, when we come back from this break, we will be talking about Thunderbirds, both modern and native, from the book Big Bird by King Gerhard. King Gerhard will be joining us as our pre-recorded guest in our upcoming segment right after this commercial break, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and thank you so much for holding on through those quick commercial breaks. And thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. They are your source for amazing CBD products. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious 7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two, count them, two edibles for free on the way out the door. Our guest in this segment is the amazing King Gerhard. He is a cryptozoologist. He is a talking head on so many shows. The new Proof is Out There season is out there, and he is on numerous of those episodes. We will be talking about his book, Big Bird, and Thunderbirds, pterosaurs, things like that. Welcome back to the show, King Gerhard. How are you doing, bud?
Hey, Christopher. It's always an honor and a pleasure, my friend. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming back on. It's always great talking with you. I got a chance to catch up with you, I guess, a couple weeks ago before the last Symposium of the Strange. And As I was there, I got to thinking about my upcoming schedule, and I was like, you know what? I've done shows with Jason McLean, things like that, on pterosaur sightings. He wrote, of course, the DFW monster book, but your book Big Bird specifically and the cases of Thunderbirds back in the 70s, things like that are fascinating, especially the way that they tie in with Native American lore, things like that. So how did you first come to the world of Thunderbird study and come into this, Ken?
Well, thanks for asking. Yeah, I'd say about 25, 30 years ago, I started doing, you know, active field research for, you know, Bigfoot and some other cryptids. I knew about the Thunderbird phenomenon because I'd read some books, obviously, by other cryptozoologists like, you know, Lauren Coleman and Dr. Carl Shuker, Janet Collin Board, and some of those folks that had Mark Hall, some of those folks that had covered the Thunderbird, the Big Bird phenomenon. And then in October of 2003, I was introduced to a gentleman in Houston who claimed that he had had a sighting and of one of these living pterosaur creatures back in 1983 when he was a young man. And he was fairly, you know, blue collar kind of guy. His name was Ralph Guzman. And he was kind of a blue collar guy, worked as an electrician, didn't really know a lot about science and zoology and paleontology. So when he first described me, he's like, he told a friend of mine, he said, I don't know anything about Bigfoot, but I saw one of those prehistoric birds like on the Flintstones. So that was this first description of this thing. And I knew right away what he meant. So I interviewed him at length, and he came across as very sincere and credible. And according to Ralph, back in 1983, he and his friend were leaning on their old Chrysler out in the front yard. This was in Pasadena, which is just southeast of Houston.
Yep.
And he claimed that this thing just flew over their heads. He said it wasn't huge. I mean, it had a wingspan like 6 feet across. He said it was completely featherless. It had like a leathery kind of brown or tan hide type covering. It had these two indentions in the side of its head, which were very strange, not the eyes, but other kind of pockets.
Interesting.
And then it had like a head crest and then a long tail dragging behind with a little, and he drew a sketch for me, and the tail was like a very diagnostic kind of a fin shape, like a rudder type thing. So it was actually struck me at the time. It was very similar to another sighting that had occurred in the same year, 1983, down in right outside of Los Fresnos, Texas, which is down in the valley. And in that case, an ambulance driver named James Thompson was coming back from an inspection with his ambulance, and he claimed one of these things flew across the road in front of his ambulance, and it was about as wide as his ambulance, as he described it. And this that was actually covered by the local newspapers. They called it a strange bird. But again, clearly what he described had no feathers. And we have to remember that birds, one of the characteristics of all birds, that class of aves, is that they all have feathers.
Yeah.
So this thing, he said, was featherless, had these bat-like wings, and again, the same long tail with the same exact shape on the end he described as Ralph Guzman. So I thought that was compelling. So that kind of catapulted me into the mystery a bit. From there, I drove down to the Rio Grande Valley on several occasions and connected with a guy who was an old-time researcher there, who had researched the sightings for years and years, Guadalupe Cantu III. And, you know, he turned me on. He had had a sighting, and he turned me on to some other folks down there. And there are certain – if you're familiar with the valley, obviously you've got Brownsville right there in the border. But just north of there, you have Los Fresnos and Olmito, San Benito, Harlingen. And then if you go a little bit west, you've got, like, McAllen and
– Far.
So Far and Edinburgh. So there have been sightings all around that area going back to the 1970s. And I was familiar with that case. So that kind of spawned me – my interest in the phenomenon, and I decided at that time that no one had ever really written a book on the big bird phenomenon in Texas, and maybe sightings of living pterosaurs and thunderbirds. And I guess we need to delineate, Christopher, because when we say thunderbird, to a lot of people it just implies something with wings. You know, a bird has got wings and something flying through the air, but we do generally get two types of reports in this field. There are many eyewitnesses I've interviewed, dozens of seemingly credible people who swear they've seen giant feathered birds with about wingspans ranging from 12 to 20 feet across, huge birds, usually dark color, solid dark color, and a kind of a hooked beak like an accipitrid or raptor. And those connect very well to the Native American traditions you talked about. If you go around the North America, you'll hear about the Tlanawa and Wakanyan and Binase and Chegwe and Huhuk and all these different Native American names for giant birds, super eagles, thunder beings. But then we have the other types of reports we get, very similar to Jason McLean's sighting, and also the Kling brothers had a sighting when they were young, and several people I've interviewed have clearly described flying reptiles, typically featherless. And sometimes they've got that head crest that we think about when we're considering pterodactyls or the long tail, which is kind of like indicative of these ramphorhynchoids, as they're called, the earlier, smaller pterosaurs. So with regard to Big Bird in South Texas, now the name Big Bird was actually invented by the media, and it was in fact a play on the Sesame Street character, which was pretty big in the 1970s. I grew up in the 70s and I watched a lot of Sesame Street, so Big Bird was a popular name. But if you delve into the eyewitness descriptions, what a lot of people are talking about, at least in the Texas and South Texas, are more of the living pterosaur types.
Yeah.
They say they have bat-like features, the leathery wings, faces that are described as looking like not so much a bird, but sometimes bat-like or cat-like. Or there was even a name. It's interesting. Many of the Mexican-American people in the valley actually referred to the big bird as a tacuache, which actually means possum in Spanish. So it was the possum, even though it had wings. So that was kind of weird. So
yeah, and there was even the interesting case growing up in Houston. There was even the interesting case of the NASA gargoyle. That was spotted years ago. And knowing that these things, especially once again, that differentiation between this pterodon-like creature with leathery wings, with bony structures inside of them that are very visible, and the what would be traditionally considered thunderbird, and once again, very large feathered birds, which probably one of the largest here in Texas would be like the great horned owl, something like that, close to about a 5-foot wingspan. But we do have large turkey, vultures, things like that. Not uncommon, but something in the ranges that sightings have been, once again, between 10 and 20 feet. That's a horse of a different color. Even the sighting mentioned in the book, Big Bird, were 5 feet tall with a 3-foot long beak, you know, whitish color to the chest, black bird, interesting features.
Yeah, this is true. And you bring up a good point. Now, we have to consider that at least some percentage of eyewitnesses are actually misidentifying large birds.
Sure.
Perhaps they just get a fleeting glimpse. They're scared. They're surprised, shocked. There are some what I refer to as big bird mimics and also pterosaur mimics. And in terms of the big bird mimics, it depends on where you are in the country. Obviously, if you're out in Southwest California or Utah or the Grand Canyon, you could actually possibly see a condor. There are California condors, a few hundred flying around in those areas, and those have about a 9-foot wingspan. But as far as the largest birds in North America, you have the white pelican, Pelicanus americanus, which has probably about a 10-foot wingspan. They're pretty big. People know what pelicans look like, though, right? Mm. Then you get into like your eagles, you know, your golden eagle, Aquila chrysaetos, has about a 7 or 8 foot wingspan on the female. Bald eagles, close to that. Storks and cranes, sandhill cranes, wood storks, and the like. And, you know, I often like to discount the vultures, Christopher. I'm sure it's the same for you in Austin. I see 100 vultures a day. I mean, they're so common.
Yes.
I doubt anyone would identify a vulture for a mystery animal, and big horned owls. So there, you know, you have these candidates of big birds that could potentially be misidentified as, you know, it's these thunderbirds, big bird type things. So that probably does happen. Now, I do have an Excel spreadsheet where I've amassed all of the traditional thunderbird, big bird, not the pterosaur type, but the big bird type reports. I probably have the largest database, I would think, of any researcher of sightings going back to the 1800s. And some interesting archetypes emerge. So, for example, in terms of the traditional thunderbirds, the average estimated wingspan that people describe is about 14 or 15 feet across. Some describe bigger, 20 feet. Some it's a little bit shorter, or, you know, 12 feet. Some of this is obviously due to the difficulty in estimating the size and wingspan of something that's flying up in the air. Probably be easier if something were perched on the ground or on a building or something. But when people see something in the air, it's hard to get that perspective, right? Is it bigger and farther away, or is it smaller and closer? But if you go through, you know, the hundreds of sightings, 14 to 15 feet is the average estimated wingspan. Solid dark color, as I mentioned, mostly typically black feathers, but sometimes dark gray or gray, and sometimes brown. White is kind of rare, but you do get a couple of those. And then, as I said, the hooked beak, which is usually like, you know, like a predator, like a raptor type of beak. So that's pretty, you know, with some degree of variation, but overall, it's pretty consistent with that. Now, in terms of the other type, let's talk about our living pterosaur group.
Yeah.
Those creatures, there's a much more variation in terms of what people are describing. Some people describe the massive 20, 30-foot wingspans of, you know, a pterodactyl. As you know, Christopher, one of the largest specimens ever found was Quetzalcoatlus northropii, which was discovered in Big Bend back in the 1970s, as fossils were. It was huge. It was about 14 feet tall and had 40-foot wingspan. So, and they typically, many of the later ones had that kind of a sail on the top of their head, you know, what we think of as a crest or probably helped them with propulsion or, you know, it's like a big rudder or something. Other eyewitnesses have described the smaller types of pterosaurs with like a wingspan 5 to 6 feet across, and often describe that long tail, like a long reptilian or serpentine tail with a diamond shape on the end.
Yeah.
And there's a technical name for that on pterosaurs that I can't remember. It starts with a C. But anyways, so you have a lot of variation in color and size. So that's a little more problematic as a researcher. If we're trying to make a case for an unidentified species, which is what we like to do in the field of cryptozoology, that's the fun part. If you want to speculate, in terms of the feathered thunderbird types, because you have a fairly consistent model, you could make a case that it's some type of unknown giant bird species, probably very rare. And many researchers will relate it to the ancient pteratorns. And now it's confusing because we're talking about there's no P in pteratorn, only in pterosaur. Okay. Pteratorns were these giant accipterids or birds that lived in North America during the Ice Age. They had 12 to 18 foot wingspans. So they actually fit the descriptions of the modern thunderbirds quite well. But now if we're talking about the pterosaurs with the P, I mean, those were around for 160 million years from the lower Triassic up through the end of the Cretaceous, the end of the Mesozoic era. And those ones, you know, I mean, that's a long time ago, Christopher. I mean,
yeah,
it's supposed that something survived the last 10,000 years without science catching on. But now if we're going to push that window back 65 million years ago, there is no fossil evidence that I'm aware of that is more recent than 65, 66 million years ago of pterosaurs. So that's a pretty big gap.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's a fascinating mystery because you have all these different variables. And I'm certainly not questioning the veracity of the eyewitnesses that have seen these things, because I've interviewed dozens and dozens of, you know, and they're usually pretty credible people that have a pretty – seem to have a pretty good head on their shoulders and some knowledge of, you know, what birds look like and what these other things look like and so forth. So,
yeah. Yeah. And, you know, one of my favorite things about you, Ken, and about reading your work is that you will absolutely give a case, give an example, things like that. And if you yourself think that, you know, well, you know, this witness was okay, but there was something with them that was a little amiss, I think, like, you fully say that in your work. So you are not a researcher that's prone to flights of fancy. You aren't a researcher that's prone to necessarily coaxing an account to fit the narrative, you know? And that's one of the things that I love about your work, is that you truly do keep the science involved with it. And even when it comes to the, once again, the hard classification of these kinds of sightings and the differentiation between them.
Well, I appreciate that. I try to approach these things as pragmatically as possible. And the scientific method is about, you know, trying to remain agnostic, objective, and look at just evidence and data and not, you know, wishful thinking too much. Now, I have to say, I hate to call anyone out by names, but there was a gentleman that contacted me a few years ago. I think his name is David Verhines, and he has a website, Super Thunderbird. And he contacted me to let me know that he had sighted a Thunderbird flying over Pennsylvania when he was working as a truck driver years ago. And he had written a book. He wanted to write a book about it and his experience. And he wanted to reference my book, which he was gracious enough to ask for permission and stuff, said he'd give me credit and stuff. But his estimate was a wingspan 270 feet across. So, yeah, that's a little bit out of the scope of what we could even imagine in biology to be real. And, you know, I've always, Christopher, I always try to be respectful to people. I'm not going to, you know, but yeah, you know, I had that discussion with him. It's like, that's impossible. There's no way there's anything flying around with a 270 foot wingspan. This doesn't work.
That bird would be massive. It would be 300 feet tall. Almost.
Yeah. It'd be like a Godzilla.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a Mothra status creature.
But anyways, if anyone wants to go look out for his website, Super Thunderbird, it's, you know, he's a colorful guy and he's got a book for sale and, you know, maybe he has a story to tell. Who knows? But, so yeah, we have to disregard those types of sightings, obviously. But, you know, typically people are within that range. I mean, you know, you get the upper end of 20, 30 foot wingspan, which is pretty shocking. But I think, you know, 14, 15 feet is a palatable estimate in terms of, I mean, it'd be darn big. And for someone, for example, you know, like we talked about turkey vultures, if you've looked at turkey vultures your whole yeah. life and you saw something three times as big as a turkey vulture, you would probably know that.
Yeah, as somebody who hunted as a child, things like that, spent time out fishing and observing wildlife, birds, things like that, I remember the first time that I saw, A, an owl up close, and B, that same owl fly off. And it was in the middle of Houston, like dark road near where my mom lived. And there was a fire hydrant and I saw something next to it and it was the same size as the fire hydrant.
Oh, wow.
And its head turned around and its eyes were just golden saucers because of my headlights. And when the wings unfurled, they were massive. They were mad. I mean, it was a huge owl. It was easily a wingspan the width of my vehicle. And I'd seen vultures up close, things like that, you know, over roadkill, all kinds of things. But to see that in the middle of the night, you know, when you wouldn't see a vulture flying or eating or anything like that, that will scare you. When you're just shocked. turning a blind corner and that thing turns around, you see its eyes, you see the wings unfurl, and then it flies directly in front of your vehicle, it'll send you for a swerve real quick. So if you see something that is, let's just say, 300 feet while you're driving a truck, I can imagine it would be something that would be a life-shaking and life-changing moment, Ken. You know, even if you see something 20 feet.
Very sincere.
Even if you see something 20 feet. That is very, very large. Now, historically, do we have anything in fossil record, anything like that? Because of course, South American condors are considerably larger than American condors, you know, do we have anything locally in fossil record, anything here in America that would fit the bill, anything that may have amongst the great wilds of America, have gone unnoticed?
Yeah, well, so again, Quetzalcoatlus northropii was a massive pterodactyl that lived at the end of the Cretaceous and probably had about a 30 to 40 foot wingspan. So I've stood next to a recreation of one of those, and it's, I mean, mind-boggling. That would be pretty huge. You know, if you can imagine something with a 40-foot wingspan, just, you know, as wide as a trailer or a mobile home or something, you know. And then we have, I think there were some, oh, man, there have been a handful of pterodactyls found in that size range. Nothing larger than that that I'm familiar with. I think 30 to 40 feet is the largest estimated wingspan of anything that's ever flown. Lived and flown on our planet. So, modern wingspans, you know, you mentioned the Andean condor, probably an 11 foot wingspan on the top end. The wandering albatross actually has the longest wingspan of any bird in North America, though they're very thin, kind of gracile wings. Yeah, there you go. There's some pictures of a Quetzalcoatlus reconstruction. Stood about as tall as a giraffe when it was on the ground. Now, pterosaurs were interesting because they walked on four legs. You can kind of see that posture there. Their front, similar to bats, you know, an example of convergent evolution here, because similar to bats, the pterosaurs had an incredibly long digit. Their wings were their hands, basically, or a membrane stretched across their finger bones. So pinky finger was incredibly long, and then the membranous skin kind of attached to that and then spread across to their body. And they had kind of short legs, and they had finger-like projections, fingers sticking out of the top of the wing. So they could actually get down when they were on the ground and kind of walk quadrupedally. So that's kind of an interesting adaptation. My friends who are paleontologists tell me there's still a lot of speculation that goes on about some of these fossil forms. You know, we we glean more and more each year as we study them and find better fossils. But it is believed that most pterosaurs were probably, you know, fish eaters, probably lived near water, probably similar to condors. They probably used like high bluffs and kind of elevation to kind of fall and glide.
Find the thermoclines and glide rather than actually try to use muscle mass to flap their wings.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so Quetzalcoatlus, yeah, they're estimating 11 to about 40 feet long. And then the fourth digit is the elongate one. Oh, yeah, we need to talk about the fibers. So,
oh, please.
There have been some really remarkable fossil discoveries in recent years of pterosaurs that clearly show that their bodies were covered, not necessarily their wings, but their bodies were covered in these feather-like structures called pycnofibers. They were kind of like early proto-feather type things, and it probably helped them thermoregulate. So there's a good chance that pterosaurs may have been warm-blooded or endothermic like modern birds and some dinosaurs. And so, you know, they had these feather-like structures on their body, which kind of adds to the confusion a little bit, Christopher, because, you know, people, you know, if they've asked me, well, how can we have two types of Thunderbird reports? We have the, you know, the traditional Thunderbird, feathered Thunderbirds, and then we have these living pterosaur reports. Well, is it possible that either pterosaurs looked more like birds than we ever imagined? And there are some reconstructions of them that make them look more bird-like because of these feather-like structures. And that could potentially lead to them eyewitnesses referring to them as birds because of that bird-like appearance. Or if there are, in fact, living pterotaurs, the Ice Age giant vulture-type birds from the Ice Age, could they look so weird and prehistoric to us that some people, you know, will mistake them for having more of a reptilian appearance? Or a prehistoric is a word that comes up a lot when people are trying to describe these things. What does that mean? I guess it means different things to different people, right? It looks kind of ancient and, you know, like a fossil or something. So, there's a lot of cool science behind this. If you really get into it and study the different types of sightings and reports, and these new fossil finds all the time. There you go. Archaeopteryx, the first bird.
Yep. That's kind of the bridge link between these animals and birds, possibly. And that's just it. When you start looking at things, one of the things and I was very glad to hear you bring up the habitat that they tend to find these pterosaurs and pteranodons, things like that in, are coastal areas that are near rivers, near water bodies, things like that. When you look at specifically the head structures of these things, like you can see where spoonbills, like spoonbill cranes, things like that may have evolved from. You can see where, like you were saying, pelicans, things like that are a great modern example that is very familiar to this shape. So you can see where there may be link along the biological chain in that kind of way.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're all of those birds, pterosaurs, and I think even crocodilians are all considered archosaurs. And an archosaur is a, you know, basically they have very diagnostic features in terms of the way the skull is shaped. And they have these temporal fenestrae, which are like these two holes behind the eye sockets and things. So there is definitely a relationship there between, well, we all know from Jurassic Park fans know that birds basically evolved from dinosaurs. Yeah. And the pterosaurs were like, they weren't dinosaurs. They were like a distinct lineage, but they were close enough and in that grouping, you know, to where they had some shared features.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were really fascinating animals. And think about it, Christopher. Pterosaurs ruled the Earth's skies for 160 million years. There were no birds at that time. I guess Archaeopteryx probably sprung up during the Jurassic or something like that. But for a long time, it was the pterosaurs were the dominant species in the air. And then, of course, as they began to die out and the dinosaurs died out, then the birds kind of sprung up and filled that niche. So,
yeah. Yeah. And when you're talking about that, when you're talking about, once again, and this is something that we discuss with not only you, but other cryptozoologists, is the idea of when you're searching for an animal, does it have the available food source? Does it have the available area to be able to breed without competition, to be able to breed without fear of predation, things like that? So would it be possible for a small grouping of these, and because that's what it would take. It would take more than just a random breeding pair, you know, to have survived.
Yeah, there would have to be, you're right, a viable breeding population to avoid genetic bottlenecks and things like that. I don't know how to even speculate on something like that, but, you know, you're talking about at the very, very minimum several hundred, you know, and maybe in the low thousands. So that, again, creates another issue in terms of why aren't people reporting them more often? Mm. Or why in this amazing age of, you know, photography and drones and cell phone cameras, haven't we gotten better images? I'll tell you an interesting sidebar in terms of alleged photographic evidence of Thunderbirds. So the most famous alleged Thunderbird photographic image of all is known as the Thunderbird photo, and it was allegedly taken in the year 1890. According to the story, there were some ranchers out near Tombstone, Arizona, who'd shot this giant flying crocodile-like thing out in the desert. And they took it back to town, dragged its body back to town, and then there was a photograph taken with about 6 or 12, depending on who this story who's telling the story, men stretching this thing out in front of a barn. And this is you're showing a photo here, which is, there have been many hoaxed, fabricated reconstructions of this famous alleged photo. So the, before everyone out there starts sending me photos from Google Images, I've seen all of these, and they are clever reconstructions. But this, you get the idea. So according to some early researchers, in the a guy named Frank Pearl in 1965, writing for Fate magazine, and then there was a guy named Hiram Cramner around that time in Pennsylvania who claimed that he had seen this photo. So a lot of researchers back in the day claimed that they had actually seen this photograph, this old photograph. Researchers including John Keel, author of Mothman Prophecies, Ivan Sanderson, founding father of cryptozoology, and so forth. But then the photo disappeared, supposedly, and no one has seen a copy of it in years and years. I occasionally hear from people still that claim that they saw this famous photograph in an old book or an old magazine, but they can't quite remember where or when, you know? So it's kind of a Mandela effect aspect to the mystery. So that's the most famous alleged Thunderbird photograph. Now, in recent years, and I consider I have a pretty high profile as a researcher of these particular cryptids because I'm on a lot of TV shows and I write books about them and stuff. I've had at least three different individuals that have contacted me through the years that claim that they knew where there was an actual photograph of one of these Thunderbirds. And in all three cases, I tried to follow those leads and track it down. And ultimately, there was always some mysterious reason why the photograph could not be obtained. In one case, the guy had moved back to Mexico. He had the only copy. There was a lady in Canada who said that she saw a picture of a Thunderbird in a Native American museum. But, you know, I couldn't follow that track down. I forget the third one. But isn't that interesting, Christopher, that whenever anyone comes to me and says, oh, yeah, I know where there's a photo of one of these Thunderbirds. And, of course, you know, I'm on the trail right away. Like, okay, you know, I how can I get a copy of this? And then ultimately it just fizzles out every time. And it's just like, no, you can't see it.
And there are, there are those out there who would be like, well, that's the National Forestry Service at work. You know, they don't want you to know about the Thunderbirds or the groups of troops that guard their migration. You know, I mean, things like that get a little bit out of pocket.
I got a good story.
And they're out there.
Interject me. There was a guy named Barry Cedeno who contacted me and said that his father worked as a Border Patrol agent years ago and that they were on patrol and they pulled up on a military truck removing a dead pterodactyl off the road. And it was basically a hush-hush thing. We're like, you know, don't talk about this. And we got this under control. So, yeah, you're right. You get those conspiracy theories, too. You know, what happened to the bodies?
Yeah.
What happened to the evidence?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I guess and I mean, the Men in Black got it.
You get it in the Sasquatch community as well, you know. And it's interesting. And they're fun things to listen to. But you do have to kind of wonder, like, what would be the vested interest and why? You know, why would you want to hide something like that? Even now, it's the fact that I tag you with articles on Facebook all the time for your cryptozoology class. One of them was the recent find of that huge pterodon thigh bone that was like taller than a man. Like, I'm a tall guy and the scientist was about my height and it had about 4 feet on him.
Yeah.
You know, and when you look at that, it's like, my God, look at the size of this animal that, yes, once flew over the skies of South America and North America. Now, the question comes to bear through mass extinction events, through deforestation, through everything else. Would one be able to survive? You know, would a grouping of them be able to survive?
I don't know if that's possible, really. And the only thing that I've been able to come up with, and it's a far-fetched theory, but in terms of a breeding population of living pterosaurs, I think the only location in North America where they could be hiding would be like the Sierra Madre Mountains in northern Mexico, which are pretty remote. I've been there, and you know, it's a pretty remote area, very low population density, very different from what we're talking about in terms of known pterosaur habitats. Definitely not near a lot of water, not near the ocean, or, you know, it's kind of a lot of desert and stuff.
Yeah.
But the reason I bring that up is because all the sightings along the Rio Grande Valley, and based on limited contacts with Mexican researchers, I'd say you have also a lot of reports of these things in northern Mexico. But there are actually engravings. There are some Aztec ruins near the city of Veracruz known as Tajin, T-A-G-I-N, where supposedly there are engravings of pterosaur-like animals that were depicted by the ancient Aztecs. And I once corresponded with a cryptozoologist named Richard Greenwell, who passed away about 20 years ago. And he was the secretary for the International Society of Cryptozoologists for many years. He had a contact in East Mexico that swore that there were living pterosaurs in a particular area. And I was contacted by a woman named Darlene Dillon years ago who told me that she had actually seen a non-fossilized pterosaur skull in northern Mexico that some tourists had bought from a local guy and kind of vanished type of thing. So cool. Like I said, this is far-fetched stuff, but if you were going to pin me to the wall and say, okay, where are these things? I guess I would say, well, if there is a breeding population of living pterosaurs anywhere in the world, well, I should say anywhere in the world, because we could talk about the Ropen and Dua and New Guinea and the Kangamato, and they're around the world. There are areas where these exhibit, but in North America, it would have to be northern Mexico, I would think, in some of those remote mountain ranges, but I still think it's unlikely.
And you know, there are definite cases of things that we know to have, quote, gone extinct that have come back, you know, most definitely coelacanth, even in our own time, you know, things like the ivory-billed woodpecker has been seen once again by Forestry Service, things like that, and even photographed. So known not to be extinct anymore. Which means actually it was never extinct. Not like, you know, it just randomly two birds mated and it sprung off evolutionarily again. You know, that's not how that works. It means that it was never actually extinct. So we do have these cases amongst science, and it's interesting to study them. And when you start considering that, when you start I guess once again, yeah, I don't want to coax information. I don't want to coax data, but there seem to be a lot of sightings, Ken. And there seem to be a lot of sightings in specific areas geographically. Are there any cultural stories in Mexico or anything like that, aside from, of course, what we were just talking about with the pterodons possibly being on Aztec walls, things like that. Any other cases like that in South America or,
I don't get a lot of reports, honestly, outside of North America, Christopher. Mm. So, and not, you know, and admittedly, I don't have the boots on the ground. I mean, sure. I do know some researchers in some of those countries, but they're typically UFO researchers. As you know, that's a big thing in Latin America, yeah. Brazil and Mexico and Puerto Rico and some of those places. There are in northern Mexico, in the Sonoran Desert, there are things called devil monkeys, which I guess one could make an argument. They're supposedly like winged monkey type creatures. That sounds like maybe a small pterosaur type thing. The Tzeltal Indians of the Chiapas talk about the Ikals, which are like little man bat type creatures that live in caves. But not really. I mean, you don't really have, you know, other than the feathered serpent, you know, yeah. of Mexico, the Quetzalcoatl, which is, it gets confusing because the fossil was named after a prominent figure in Aztec and Olmec mythology who was actually supposedly a person, but
yeah,
is, I guess his,
well, the feathered serpent god.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was as many, you know, deities are kind of adorned with these kind of features or characteristics. So, but again, if you go around the world, now you have, you know, an argument for, it's an older cryptid, so you don't get, I don't hear about a lot of modern reports, but in places like Mount Kilimanjaro and Namibia and some of those places in South Central Africa, Angola, you hear about the Kangamato, which is the overturner of boats, which is described as like a kind of a pterosaur, a smaller pterosaur, highly aggressive, but leathery bat-like wings, sharp teeth, and so forth. But more recently, in recent years, we've gotten a lot of reports out of Papua New Guinea of the Kangamato, also known – I'm sorry, the Ropin, also known as the Dua or Indaba bird. And Jason, I'm sure, knows some of the guys that have been over there. But, you know, I've talked to some of these researchers for years, guys like Garth Gessman and Paul Nation and Jake Guerra and John, you know, these guys have gone over to New Guinea and searched for evidence of the Ropin, spoken to local people on places like Umboy Island, and kind of an interesting, you know, they typically describe them as looking like living pterosaurs, Christopher, but one interesting aspect, and they're said to rob graves and have other nocturnal activities, but an interesting characteristic that's been attributed to the Ropin is that it actually can glow. That it emits this bioluminescent glow or light source.
Interesting.
And in fact, my friend Paul Nation, who's done 5 expeditions down there, took a picture of one of these glowing things that in the night sky that I guess one could argue has kind of a wing-like, you know, looks like wings or something. So really, I don't have a way to, you know, I think it's an interesting theory. I don't really see a way that something like a higher vertebrate would have this. I mean, you have bioluminescence in nature, obviously, deep in the ocean and weird fish and bugs, lightning bugs and things like that.
Well,
but
no,
to attribute
granted,
a higher vertebrate that glows, that's kind of a far out idea.
Well,
so.
No, granted, I would caveat that with saying bioluminescence within the spectrum that our eyes can see. Because because there has been over the last probably 5-6 years quite a bit of bioluminescent data coming out of Australia with mammals, and it's pretty interesting. So when you start considering the especially nocturnal mammals, so when you start considering the fact of like these things appear only under long wave UV condition, you know, that kind of stuff, only under infrared condition. So if that's a spectrum range that animal can see in, absolutely a great means by which for them to have specialized breeding, all kinds of things in the environment that they live. But if you're talking a bioluminescence like a jellyfish or a firefly, I'm with you on that. I wouldn't generally think that the biosphere of a mammalian body would necessarily do that.
You bring up an excellent point. You know, obviously our eyes are limited in terms of the spectrums that we can see and identify. So that is an interesting idea. But what's really kind of intriguing is that Garth Gessman and Jay Guerra and some of these other Ropen researchers that live in North America have kind of shifted their research from New Guinea, for obvious reasons, it's very expensive and dangerous to go there, to North America. And I've talked to them about how there are sightings, and we know there are sightings because I've interviewed many eyewitnesses here in North America that have seen them. But they are actually going out at night, and they're seeing anomalous lights in the sky, the Marfa lights, in fact. They thought, were speculating, could be some of these pterosaurs, living pterosaurs flying around at night. So it's almost they've almost kind of become UFO researchers, Christopher. They're out at night, with cameras and telescopes and things, and taking pictures of anomalies in the air flying around, and they're identifying them as pterosaurs. Or, you know, so I don't know. You know,
yeah.
Bully to them for doing the research, because at least they've got boots on the ground and they're making a strong effort to document something. But I'm not sure if I'm sold on that idea yet.
No, and granted, you know, we were talking about specifically that familiarity, body type, things like that, the pterosaurs specifically have with bats, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they were a nocturnal animal. You know, and you don't really have a whole, there are some birds that will migrate overnight, you know, geese, stuff like that are known to do that. And probably an hour or two post dusk, you know, stuff like that. Living in West Houston, we saw them flying over to Katy regularly in the evening time, 8 o'clock at night, things like that. Now, 10 o'clock at night, 11? No, not necessarily. You know, they're normally bedded down, but I don't know about a whole lot of birds that are truly active during the nighttime hours in that kind
of
way.
Just the owls, pretty much. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And most of that is due to what they eat, you know, and how they eat.
That's a good point. There are a lot of reports or sightings of these big birds, thunderbirds, pterosaurs, whatever you want to call them, at night. Not exclusively, but more than you would expect to see from a species. Because like you said, you'd have to understand more about the predation patterns and, you know, what are these things eating and, you know.
Well, Appendix 1 in the book is entitled Pterosaur Dawn and Dusk. You have tons of sightings in here, and that's what I love about it, is that you have all the sightings, appendicized, everything else. Amongst those, Ken, how many have happened in the modern era? How many reports do you get, let's say, in the last decade?
Oh, man. I usually get a handful of intriguing reports per year. So like last year, I remember there was a woman from New Mexico. I think it was near one of the missile ranges, maybe Alamogordo or something like that. Her children had claimed that they'd seen a smaller type of pterosaur flying over, and they were pretty adamant about that. Prior to that, there was a cluster of sightings up in Oklahoma that Lyle Blackburn and I investigated and featured in our American Monster Tour documentary. We call it the Oklahoma Demon Flyer, which was kind of an homage to the Ropen. Ropen means demon flyer, supposedly, in the native tongue. This was up west of Oklahoma City in the town of Bethany and out near Yukon in Bethany, Oklahoma.
All right.
I think that I had a pretty good Thunderbird sighting in New Braunfels a few years ago. A guy I can't remember his name, Casey something, who I talked to at length, was out walking his dog, and he claimed he saw this massive bird with a 20-foot wingspan flying overhead. And as luck would have it, he left his phone in the house, so he wasn't able to take a picture of it. So, you know, I got sightings up near you in the Austin area, Round Rock, and so yeah, you know, every year I probably get a higher concentration from Texas because I'm in Texas. So I still get reports from the Valley. I get reports from the San Antonio area, Austin area, and even Houston, and occasionally up near Dallas or Northeast Texas. Wow. And then Oklahoma, the American Southwest, get a lot of reports from Arizona, New Mexico. And then you have as far as the traditional thunderbirds that we were talking about, the feathered type, some kind of hotbed areas include north central Pennsylvania, which I investigated those reports a few years ago, central Illinois, and also Alaska. And really the most compelling reports I've gotten in recent years, Christopher, are from Alaska. They're not of the pterosaur type, but of the traditional Native American feathered thunderbird type. I was contacted by several individuals that, to my knowledge, don't know each other, but they live kind of in the areas, if you're familiar with the areas on the outskirts of Anchorage, you've got Wasilla and Palmer, and then east of there you have the Matanuska Glacier. There have been several people that have contacted me that swear that they saw a bird, jet black in color, hooked beak, and a wingspan of about 14 feet across, so much larger than an eagle. And we have to acknowledge that people in Alaska are real familiar with eagles. Yes. They see a lot of them up there.
Yeah.
So so several different sources over a span of a few years reporting these big black thunderbirds. And in 2019, there were a number of sightings down near Juneau, and those made the newspapers. So Alaska, I think, and I've told people this, if you're going to make an argument for a giant winged species that has not been acknowledged by science, Alaska is going to be your best bet in North America. I mean, we're talking about vast habitat, 600,000 square miles of 37 mountain ranges, 4 million lakes, 6,000 miles of coastland.
Yep.
Endless salmon runs and food supplies. So yeah, as a zoologist, you could get a little geeky about that, you know. Oh wow, maybe there is something up there because you got this vast unexplored areas.
Yeah, you've got a wilderness quite literally the size of Texas and more biodiverse.
Yeah. So I mean those are interesting reports up in Alaska. And I actually I have one pterodactyl report from Alaska, one solitary one. It's actually east in Alaska, kind of on the border with Yukon there in Western Canada. So that's kind of far out. I don't know if pterodactyls would be flying around up in Northern Canada, but who knows? So it's all fun to speculate about. So
yeah. And, you know, once again, the decades and decades of these accounts, not just here in Texas, but beyond, are fascinating. Fascinating. There's always the story from the Midwest in the 70s of the kid that was picked up and dropped in his backyard.
Marlon Lowe. Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. There are numerous famous stories about these. And it is fascinating to see that they extend into modern day, that they extend into suburban and urban areas, you know. So it's not like development has necessarily stopped them, you know, and that's interesting to consider as well.
So. Have you ever seen that movie Q?
No.
That's out there. There's a movie called Q. It's from the early 80s, and it's about a giant prehistoric bird that roosts in an old abandoned skyscraper in New York City. And it comes out at night and clutches people, grasps people off of rooftops. Stars Michael Moriarty. It's kind of a fun, it's I'll a little bit offbeat. It's kind of a quirky, offbeat, kind of tongue-in-cheek horror movie. I think it was, I can't name the name of the director, but he's done a lot of these, like, really weird. But anyways, if for any fans out there that just like a good science fiction movie about a thunderbird or a giant bird, check out Q from the early 80s. It's a really fun movie, and, you know, kind of plays off this whole motif that we're talking about.
I will add that to the short watch list. I just wrote that down on my show notes. So, man, want to thank you. So, and you know, even looking as I was scrolling through the Rapun a while ago, the traditional statue of it is strikingly similar to the bird's head that we were talking about a while ago, to the Thunderbird head, where it's like it had a 3-foot long beak, you know? So that was interesting to me, the fact that was a similar attribute there. And when you're talking about these sightings across the globe of modern Thunderbirds, not the native Thunderbird, but the idea of pterodons, pterosaurs, that kind of stuff. Once again, it's not just here in the American Southwest in Texas. They range all over the place. So it is interesting to look at and a fascinating phenomenon to study. So thank you so much for the work that you have done into it. Thank you so much for your work in the book Big Bird, amazing book. You can stop on by and get that. Let everybody know real quick before we let you go, Ken, where they can go to get your book. You also have an amazing winged cryptids course. You have a whole series of courses. I myself took them. I have my certificate from King Gerhard. Let everybody know where they can go to find your classes, where they can go to sign up, where they can go to get their copy of Big Bird and other works by you, Ken.
Well, I appreciate it, Christopher. Thanks for having me on once again. I have a website, kengerhard.com. And if you're interested in my 6-class online cryptozoology course, I'm actually starting a new session this Saturday, December 7th. And so you can enroll by going to my website, kengerhard.com, and then clicking the tab on the top that takes you to cryptozoology courses. And then it takes you to Patreon. And I have different options, including the live course. There's for $60 a month, 2-month obligation, you get the live course. Or if you're on a budget and you're just kind of a casual, for $25 a month, I will send you a pre-recorded high quality class each month with all the related materials, quizzes, and so forth. And as you mentioned, you can earn a certificate.
Absolutely.
If you take all 6 classes. So
absolutely. And man, as you know, I go to a lot of conferences. I attend a lot of conferences just professionally. I hear doctors speak, all kinds of things. But you are an amazing lecturer, Ken. You really do put some good work into the research that you've done for these classes, and the amount of work and data that is in each class is voluminous and amazing. So I cannot recommend them more, folks. His classes are phenomenal. You will learn tons, not only about the actual history of cryptozoology and wing cryptids, things like that, but like we've been talking about, the possible evolutionary biology, things like that. So it's great stuff, man. It's awesome that you've put that
together. Thank you, man. Appreciate your kind words.
You bet. Hold the line real quick while we close things out. Once again, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate you coming on and sharing your vast wealth of knowledge about winged cryptids and especially Thunderbirds with us tonight, man.
Absolutely. We'll have to do it again real soon.
You bet. While you are online checking out everything from kengerhard.com, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com/store is where you can find not only Ken's books and classes, but also books, classes, videos from our other guests as well. You can also stop on by CuriousResearch.org. That's where you can pick up your copy of our field observation and encounter log. If you are a cryptozoologist, if you are a field researcher in the world of paranormal, UFO, UAP, what have you, this is there to help you gather all of your data while you're in the field. Stop on by, check that out. CuriousResearch.org is the website. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight, for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics,
and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.